If the Supreme Court has a grand finale, it is this week. This is the last week of oral arguments before the justices hunker down and polish off this year's opinions. They're considering a case that would make homelessness illegal, a case that might let hospitals refuse to offer women life-saving abortion care. And on Thursday, they're going to go out with a bang, considering whether Donald Trump, as a former president, can declare himself immune from prosecution. I'm a little overwhelmed, I gotta say. Like, there's so many cases.
So am I, and I do this for a living.
Ian Millhiser covers the court for Vox. I called him up not so much to talk about the people arguing their cases this week, but all the people who won't have the chance. I wonder if with all the activity at the Supreme Court, you ever think it kind of prevents us from seeing the ways the Supreme Court impacts our lives without a hearing or a ruling at all?
Yes.
Ian wrote a piece the other day about a case that most Supreme Court reporters have ignored. And there's a good reason for that. It is not being argued. This case is known as Doe v. McKesson. It's about who's responsible when a protest goes wrong. And it's been on a years-long journey, bouncing from the trial court to the appellate division. The Supreme Court has sent it back to the lower courts twice now. It's part of what looks like a strategy to Ian, of the justices' slow-walking, urgent constitutional questions.
You know, when there's a Republican policy that's blocked by a judge, they're like, how fast can we move to get this thing back in place? When there's a Democratic policy that's blocked by a lower court judge, you know, they eventually get around to saying, oh, yeah, this is what the law said. But, you know, it's 10, 11, 12 months before they do so.
Today on the show, we're going to dig into Doe v. McKesson. The Supreme Court has kept it on ice for 5 years. So long that Ian says now, the First Amendment right to protest may not exist throughout the South. I'm Mary Harris. You're listening to What Next? Stick around. According to Ian, all this started 8 years back with one community activist.
DeRay McKesson is a fairly prominent Black Lives Matter organizer. You know, a lot of people have probably heard of him. He's the guy who always wears the blue vest.
Yeah, he hosts Pod Save the People. He's a civil rights activist.
Right. Within police reform circles, he's a very big deal. In 2016, there was a police shooting. A man named Alton Sterling was killed by police in Baton Rouge. And so DeRay helped organize a protest in Baton Rouge, and the tragedy compounded tragedy because one of the attendees at the protest threw a rock and it injured a police officer very seriously. He suffered, you know, according to one court, he suffered a brain injury. He suffered a serious jaw injury. So, you know, I don't want to minimize what happened to this officer. Like, it's, you know, a terrible, terrible crime was committed against this officer. There's no indication that he did anything wrong. The person who threw the rock at this officer, that person should be in prison. He committed a terrible crime. But everyone agrees that DeRay wasn't the person who threw a rock.
Still, that police officer, who's only identified anonymously as John Doe, sued DeRay McKesson as the event's organizer.
And it has never been the case that if you host an event or if you organize an event where you bring some people into town and one of them does something illegal, that the event organizer is responsible. If you say that a protest organizer can be liable for anything that someone at the protest does, no one in their right mind is ever going to organize a protest again. Because when you bring thousands of people into town for any event, the likelihood that one of them is going to break the law, is close to 100%. That's just not how the law works. Again, take the First Amendment out of it. If Taylor Swift holds a concert, we don't hold her responsible if someone who comes into town for the concert breaks a law. If, like, someone comes into town for the Super Bowl and on their their way to the stadium, they shoplift, or, you know, or they punch a police officer, they do whatever terrible thing they want to do. The NFL is not responsible for that. Like, you know, we couldn't have public events if the people who organize public events are responsible for the illegal actions of anyone who attends that event.
Well, isn't there case law, too, having to do with protest and what's allowed and what's proper?
There was a case in 1982 called Cleburne Hardware. And what happened in the Cleburne Hardware case was, in the 1960s, there was a boycott. The NAACP helped organize it in Mississippi of several white-owned businesses in order to try to, you know, put pressure on the local community to change some of its racist policies. And things got pretty contentious. Charles Evers, one of the leaders of the protest, did far more to, you know, potentially incite violence than DeRay McKesson ever did. There was a speech where he allegedly said that if anyone goes into one of the racist white-owned businesses, he would break their damn neck.
It's threatening language.
Exactly. And so you had this case where you had this protest organizer was using very strong language to try to, you know, ensure that the boycotts hewed together, eventually went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, no, the First Amendment does not allow a protest organizer to be sued if some member of the protest does something illegal, unless there is extraordinary circumstance, you know, unless the protest organizer authorized or ratified or somehow encouraged it.
So this seems like clear precedent.
It is crystal clear precedent. If I had been the appellate judge in the McKesson case, my opinion would have said the case is dismissed plus a citation to Cleburne Hardware, and that would have been it.
So when Doe v. McKesson was first filed, did you take it seriously?
I wasn't even aware of the case initially. It went before a federal district judge. The federal district judge did the obvious thing and said, yeah, this case needs to be dismissed, and cited Cleburne Hardware. And then it went up to the Fifth Circuit. And if you're not familiar with the Fifth Circuit is where law goes to die.
Quite the statement there, Ian.
Well, this is the same court that recently declared an entire federal agency, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, unconstitutional. It is dominated by Trump appointees. You know, within the judiciary, we're actually seeing a real divide between kind of MAGA Republicans and normie Republicans. And the Fifth Circuit is dominated by MAGA Republicans.
Who are living their best lives, it sounds like.
Yeah, they are. They think they are in their reputation era. Like they are just going as hard as they can. So the Fifth Circuit took this McKesson case and they said, oh, no, we're going to make up a new exception to the First Amendment.
Huh.
Essentially, what they said is that there's a new exception to the First Amendment. If you organize a protest and you create what they called unreasonably dangerous conditions, then you are liable for the actions of the attendees. And then they, in explaining why McKesson created unreasonably dangerous conditions, they said, well, he staged the protest next to the police building and he violated a traffic law. He led the protest into the street.
A lot of protests block traffic.
Yeah, like if you know anything at all about the civil rights movement in the 1960s, a lot of street protests in that era. Like if, you know, if your First Amendment rights cease to exist the minute you violate a traffic law by illegally stepping into a street, there isn't a First Amendment right to protest. But they were handed such a terrible case and they went out of their way to find a way to strip DeRay of his constitutional rights.
So what happened when this case got appealed to the Supreme Court? Because it sounds like the Fifth Circuit has been doing a lot of work here, but, you know, the Supreme Court is basically their boss.
So, like, the Supreme Court has now twice refused to take responsibility for the case. The first time they refused to take responsibility to the case, they tried to, like, make the Louisiana Supreme Court take responsibility for it. And then the most recent development, this is what happened, you know, this month, is that it went up to the Supreme Court. They turned the case away. And meanwhile, I mean, it's been 5 years since the Fifth Circuit first ruled against DeRay, this cloud has been hanging over his head. You know, he's fortunate enough to be represented by the ACLU, but if he was any other person, he would be paying his lawyers hundreds of dollars an hour.
What does it functionally mean? that this case has been knocked back to the Fifth Circuit? Because I understand it's not great for DeRay McKesson, but what does it mean for the rest of us?
So what it means for the rest of us is that if you live in Texas, Mississippi, or Louisiana, and those are the three states that are presided over by the Fifth Circuit, then if you organize a protest and something goes wrong at that protest, you know, some attendee does something illegal and you get sued, you're going to get sued in federal court. The district court, the trial court that hears your case, is bound by the Fifth Circuit's precedent, so they're going to have to rule against you. Then it gets appealed. It goes up to the Fifth Circuit. And the Fifth Circuit has already defied the Supreme Court once. Like, they've already said, we're not going to follow this Cleburne Hardware case that was directly on point. The Fifth Circuit is going to just follow what it said in the McKesson case and say that, no, you lose. You don't have any First Amendment rights. You've got to go to trial. And then you can try to take the case to the Supreme Court. But the Supreme Court has already, you know, already showed us in the McKesson case that they don't view this issue as a big deal, that they, you know, that they're not willing to stick their neck out in order to restore your First Amendment rights.
I mean, you've said this case essentially abolishes the right to mass protest in three states. And I think you could quibble with that. You could say, like, actually it just makes the cost of protesting potentially incredibly high in those three states, prohibitively high.
Right. Yeah. I mean, like, if I were a lawyer representing a client and my client comes to me and says, I want to organize a protest in Louisiana, is that a good idea? Here's what I would tell them. I would tell them, well, you can do it. If anyone at that protest does something illegal, you could potentially be sued. If you're going to be sued, maybe you draw a lucky pick in the, you know, in the district court. But I can't even promise you that because there's a lot of loony trial court judges in Texas. Then it goes up to the Fifth Circuit. Mathematically, you are more likely than not to get a MAGA panel that's going to enthusiastically enforce McKesson against you. And then after you lose in the Fifth Circuit, we're going to have to bring this to the Supreme Court. But we already know that they turned away McKesson's case. So there's no guarantee at all that the Supreme Court is going to correct the Fifth Circuit's error. And by the way, my fee is $400 an hour.
So go with God and keep your credit card handy.
Exactly. Now, I mean, if I told you that, if I was your lawyer and I told you that, would you think that your right to protest was intact? The term that is often used in the First Amendment context is chilling effect. You know, the Supreme Court has not definitively ruled that DeRay McKesson does not have First Amendment rights, or that protest organizers do not have First Amendment rights. But if you have to go through years and years of litigation, shelling out God knows how much money to your lawyers just to do something that is clearly protected by the Constitution, you don't really have a constitutional right.
We'll be right back after a break. I'm struck by the fact that this case seems to have been kept alive by the Supreme Court and this lower court, the Fifth Circuit, working in tandem. Can you tell me more about the Fifth Circuit, like what they're doing here, what we think their motivations are?
The Fifth Circuit is made up of, you know, it's a 9-8 court right now. There are nine kind of MAGA, hardcore, you know, super Trumpy judges. And then there are eight active judges who range from like Bush conservatives who I disagree with most of the time, but like don't believe that the law is whatever they want it to be that particular day, and a few Democrats. And the MAGA wing, which is the majority wing on the Fifth Circuit, I think they are fundamentally discontented with the state of U.S. law. Some of them are just hacks.
In your professional opinion.
In my professional opinion, you know, some of them are just hacks who like approach the law as if the Republican Party were their client. You know, of those nine MAGA judges, together they add up to a majority on the Fifth Circuit for some really wacky, destabilizing outcomes.
Has the Fifth Circuit made itself more known in the last 5 years, say? And how has the Supreme Court chose to deal with that?
Certainly, I mean, amongst people who follow appellate law, I think everyone knows that the Fifth Circuit has become this, not a place where you go to if you want the actual law to matter. The Supreme Court initially, I think, sort of tolerated the Fifth Circuit's behavior. Like, there were a number of cases where a case would come up through the Fifth Circuit. The Fifth Circuit would rule that a certain Biden administration policy should be blocked. And then the Supreme Court would sit on the case for almost a year before they finally got around to saying, oh, yeah, the Fifth Circuit shouldn't have done that. You're probably familiar with the case trying to take the abortion drug mifepristone off the market. That came up from the Fifth Circuit. And if you take the Fifth Circuit's, the pharmaceutical industry filed a brief in that case warning that if you take the Fifth Circuit's reasoning seriously, it would mean that potentially thousands of drugs have to be pulled off the shelves. So, like, you know, we're not just talking about abortion here. We're talking about, you know, you might not be able to get your antibiotics because of what the Fifth Circuit did. And so this court has been a problem. And I think that the Supreme Court has been gradually coming around to the view, you know, even this very conservative Supreme Court has been gradually coming around to the view that it has to do something to rein in the Fifth Circuit. A huge amount of the Supreme Court's docket this term is cases where the Fifth Circuit wilded out.
So you're saying that the Supreme Court is kind of coming around to the idea that, okay, we have this circuit that's behaving in a way that's really different than all the other courts that are sending us cases. We may need to deal with it. But it seems like in this Doe v. McKesson case, they've taken the opposite approach. They've been like, oh, we can't deal with this. Back to the Fifth Circuit with you. How do you rectify those things? Why do they seem to be fine letting this case go back down?
I mean, the short answer is I don't know. Part of the reason I was so optimistic that they would correct the Fifth Circuit's error in the McKesson case, besides the fact that the Fifth Circuit's decision in McKesson was so egregious, is that I saw that the Supreme Court was starting to realize we got a problem here. Like, you know, this court is wilding out in ways that even people like Brett Kavanaugh and Amy Coney Barrett thought, yeah, no, that you can't do that, guys. And so because the Supreme Court was starting to crack the whip a little about the Fifth Circuit, I was very hopeful that they were going to do it in this McKesson case. And one of the reasons I worry about the McKesson case, beyond the fact that, you know, I think people in Louisiana should have First Amendment rights, is that when the Supreme Court lets this thing slide, I mean, I used to be a school teacher. And when you have a kid who's showing out all the time, if you don't crack down, you're sending the kid a message that they could do it over and over again.
You're sending all the kids the message.
Exactly. You've got all these unruly children in the Fifth Circuit who are being told by the teacher that they could do whatever they want, and they're going to keep doing whatever they want until the teacher imposes some discipline. Until the Supreme Court steps in and tells the Fifth Circuit that there will be adult supervision, they're going to behave like children without adult supervision.
Ian, thank you so much for coming on the show. Really grateful for your time.
All right, great. Thank you.
Ian Millhiser is a senior correspondent at Vox. And that's our show. If you're a fan of What Next, the best way to support our work day in and day out is to join Slate Plus. It's our membership program. Go on over to slate.com/whatnextplus to sign up. What Next is produced by Paige Osborne, Elena Schwartz, Rob Gunther, Anna Phillips, and Madeline Ducharme. We are led by Alicia Montgomery with a little boost from Susan Matthews. Ben Richmond is the Senior Director of Podcast Operations here at Slate. And I'm Mary Harris. You can follow me on X if you are still there. I'm at Mary's desk. Thanks for listening. I'll catch you back here next time.